Okay, Santiago, thanks a lot for this brief introduction. So let me start just after 9. The title I want to talk about here is today this diversification benefits, second order properties basically of such diversification benefits. I want to start with a very brief outline what you can expect from me in the next 45-50 minutes. Just very briefly, I want to give a short introduction, or let's say basically a research motivation, why I think these topics are interesting to look at. Also fix some of the notations. Then the talk itself will be consisting basically of two parts. This main part is the first part where we'll have a closer look at what I call diversification benefits and analyze them a little bit more in detail. And the second part, it's basically work in progress. This is the stuff I'm doing right now in Cornell, and I've started it back at ETH. So it's about how we could analyze the accuracy of this, people usually call this closed form OPVAR approximation of Klausberg and Claudia Klippelberg. So then, as I said, introduction. First, I want to give you this quote, which I found about more than a year ago in Financial Times. It's from Lloyd Blankfein, which is CEO of Goldman Sachs, and he was asked in an interview about his opinion on the influence of the financial crisis on current risk management practices. And among other things, of course, he said the following. So given the size and interconnected nature of markets, the growth in volumes, the global nature of traders and their cross-asset characteristics, managing operational risk will only become more important. Probably you will all agree that it is important and it will become more important, and basically, that's why we are here for these 2 days, no? So, of course, managing such risks involves many different parts, and we won't be able to talk about all of these parts, so I will focus on one particular part, on a more quantitative part, because of my background, academic background, of course. So, as I said, it's only one part, but nevertheless, it's an important part. It's this calculation of the so-called regulatory capital charge for operational risk. And the point is, and this is basically also this linked to this research motivation, the point is here, at the moment there are no, let's say, agreed standard or agreed best methods for doing this. So there's a wide range of practice at the moment that different banks use to calculate this capital, but there's no best method at the moment. I mean, there are some points that are prescribed basically by the Basel II framework, some points you have to follow, in other points banks have more or less full freedom. Not full freedom, it's always subject to regulatory approval, of course, in the end. So what are some of these points which you have to follow according to Basel II? I mean, I'm always talking about AMA banks, so I'm not talking about the standardized or BIA approach. So let's assume we have such an AMA bank, and we already divided the business into subunits, so units of measure, as they're also called. Then according to Basel II, what you have to do in order to calculate your regulatory capital, probably all know this, of course, just to fix notations, what you need to do is, for each subunit of business, you need to model the total yearly loss in that unit of business. It's basically a random variable in technical terms, so I call this SI, it's the sum of the losses in that unit of business. Then what you need to do for each of these subunits, you need to calculate the value at risk at the very high level of 99.9%. It's an important point, this high level, or a difficult point, let's say. So you do this for every business line. Then in the end, you need to sum up over all these standalone capitals to get the overall risk charge, or capital charge, risk capital charge. Then in the end, subject to regulatory approval, you might be allowed to factor in what is called in this Basel document the well-reasoned estimate of diversification benefits. Now the point for us was, at least to us, it was not so clear, and I think it's not so clear at all, what this well-reasoned exactly means. That was basically the motivation then for our first for this paper, which I want to talk a little bit about in this first part. Again, as I said briefly before, this talk is based two parts. So the first part I want to have a look at this, what I call it, this delta, analyze this delta a little bit more, and what influences this delta. In the second part, I want to focus on one single business line, basically look at how to calculate, high quantiles or value at risk for a single business line, so for a sum of losses in one business line. Okay, part one, analysis of such benefits. This is actually based on a paper which is joint work with Dominic Lambrecht. He was together with me here at ETH. He's now working at KPMG. And it's also together with Johann Sechers. He's a professor in statistics and probability. He's working at l'Université Catholique de Louvain in Belgium. So it's, as you see, it's rather recent work. I think we just finished it around the end of the year or maybe beginning of January. So basically what I will talk about in this first part is based on that paper there, and you find more details there. So why is this interesting, or is there practical relevance for this analysis of diversification benefits? The point is, so far there seems to be not very much evidence to convince regulators that always to allow debt to be non-zero. But I was just talking to Emma before, apparently banks are allowed in some cases to use this delta non-zero, so it's not always the case that they have to do this delta equal to zero and just sum up the standalone capitals. That's, but you have to have really good reasons and really sound dependence modeling, which is not so easy. On the other hand, there's strong empirical evidence that exactly questions this delta zero case. I mean, this is only a case what we call comonotonic risk. If you have comonotonic risk, so a very special case of dependence, then you would consider this delta zero case. So there's this paper, this very nicely written paper by Eric Cope and Gianluca Antonini about this observed correlations and dependence in the ORX data, where they question exactly this point here based on an analysis of Kendall's tau. So then, just very briefly, what was the aim of our paper? Basically very simple, just try to get a grasp on this delta somehow. We want to do it in an analytical way. We just did not want to just look at different simulations and then see what is the influence if we use different underlying input parameters. We wanted to do this in a more analytical way. And once we do this, of course, this allows us to somehow provide a tool to assess the sensitivity of these diversification benefits to the different underlying input variables. If you have an analytic approach, then you can analyze this a little bit better than just doing this extensive simulation, which you, because you work with heavy tail data, you need to do quite a large amount of simulations, otherwise your plots will be very wiggly and you cannot really tell anything. So that was the aim. Now, just very briefly, in mathematical terms, what we were deriving there, what we usually refer to as first and second order asymptotic properties, or just limit results, as this level tends to 1, and we consider now this alpha, this delta, just as a function of the level here that was the setting. Then the framework, of course, there's some kind of, would say this ideal framework would be that we would like to find a stochastic model now for this, what we say, random vector, this vector of these total losses in the different business lines, and ideally we would find such a model that in some sense accurately reflects the dependence structure between our business units. That would be the goal, of course. And once we have this model, we would then, of course, base our calculations of regulatory capital on that model, and in particular also we would analyze diversification benefits, or what we also call this so-called risk concentration factor C, on this dependence model, on this stochastic model. Now this C, what we use here, this risk concentration, this was the main object of interest. We just did not want to work all the time with this 1 minus delta, so that's why we called it concentration. It's basically the opposite of diversification. I mean, if you have a large number here, a high degree of diversification, then you have a low degree of risk concentration. So this just was easier to work with than with this 1 minus. So basically this C is the object of interest. It's the value at risk of the sum divided by the sum of the value at risks. And somehow was what before was the benchmark was delta equal to 0 is now just the benchmark here for the C is delta as C equal to 1. So we are interested in situations to see, are we above 1 or are we below 1? If we are below 1, then we have positive diversification effect. Are we above 1? We have a negative diversification effect, and then in fact this means that we need to put even more capital aside than just summing up the standalone capital. So this is somehow the benchmark C equals 1. Of course, it's the ideal world, let's say. Unfortunately, I think it's too ambitious. We is given the state of the art in dependence modeling. I think dependence modeling simply hasn't been pushed forward enough so that we could really achieve this goal in a sound statistical way to come up with a good dependence model in such a situation. It can do something, but it's hard to justify statistically in the end. So what we are left with basically is kind of a realistic model, or a model that allows us to do this analytically, that we analyze this risk concentration for this IID case, S1 plus D, random variables IID, non-negative. Of course, clearly, once you compare the two, you think it's probably just an overly simplified toy model that we are looking at, because we do not incorporate dependence. And the first side, this is true, and there's a but here, and the but means that on the next slide, I want to convince you that actually the dependence is not the main influence factor for this diversification benefit. It has an impact, of course, but what we find, it's not the main influence factor for diversification. So in this sense, it's maybe not so much of a toy model if we do not take this dependence into account at the first moment. So let's have a look now what I do on this next slide, where I want to convince you. I have a look at diversification under dependence. I want to see somehow what is the influence of taking different copulas. How does it change if you change the dependence structure? Then compare it to the influence of taking different marginal distributions. So how sensitive does diversification react to different copulas versus different margins? Now what you see basically is a couple of colored lines probably, and it's not so important that you can really see how every single line exactly behaves. Just wanted to see that there basically seems to be two situations. I call it the case one here with a bunch of lines up here, the case two with a bunch of lines down here. Now, what are these two cases? These two cases are basically the two different marginals which I chose. In the first case, this case one, I always look at two risks. So in the case one, I take identically distributed per margins. In both margins, I take the parameters to be both times 0.1 for the theta value and kappa equals to 20. So why these values? I just fix an arbitrary theta value, and then the kappa I just adjust it in the way that I have a tail index of 0.5. So that's why I have this kappa equals to 20, this high number. So in the first case, I have two bar margins both times with these parameter values. In the second case here, down here, I have again two bar margins, and again they have the same parameter values, but now I change the theta value to 0.3, and the kappa in this case then is 6.7. Again, I just adjust the kappa so that I have again the same tail index, 0.5. So both models have the same tail index. In this sense, they have the same heavy tailedness in the margins. Now what I do in both cases, I glue these two margins together with different copulas. I choose four different ones, and they're really different ones. The first has no tail dependence. Student T has upper as well as lower tail dependence. The Gumball has only upper tail dependence. The Clayton only lower tail dependence. So a wide range of different copula models. I take these four copulas. Then for each of these copulas, I choose three different degrees of dependence. And I choose a rather low values of Kendall's tau. This is basically based on the findings of Eric in his paper, that apparently it seems that at business line level there is not so much dependence, so that's basically why I have these low values here. So in the end I end up with these 4 times 3, so 12 dependence models for each of the cases. Then I simulate from these models 10 to the 7 simulation, then calculate the empirical risk concentration. So this gives me 12 lines here in this first case, 12 lines here in this second case. Now what is the influence of the copulas? I mean, if you change the dependence, the underlying dependence, it's rather easy to see. We just fix the margin, so we just consider one of the two cases, let's say case one first. If you change the copulas, you see that has an influence, of course. You get different lines. I mean, the risk concentration or diversification factors change a little bit. So there's basically at the 99.9 level, there's a slight variation here due to the changing dependence. But there's not much change and not much variation due to dependence. I mean, look at the second case here. This basically doesn't matter at all which dependence model you choose. You have always the same diversification benefit. On the other hand, and that's the crucial point here, if you look at the margins and change the margins a little bit means I change from theta equal to 0.1 to 0.3 and keep the tail index fixed. What then happens, basically you jump up from this case down here to this case up here just by changing a little bit the margins. I even leave the margins to be the same distribution, but has a big influence on these diversification effects. So in this one case, on average, I have maybe 10% diversification here. If I change a little bit my margins, I jump up here, on average maybe, let's say -40, -50% diversification. Just due to changing the margins, it's nothing due to dependence here. So in this sense, I would say this fallacy here, the dependence as the main driver of diversification benefits, is probably not true. I mean, it's just one example. You can do different ones and see that they behave the same way. So it's not probably not true that this is the main driver of diversification effects. On the other hand, or instead, what matters much more is the behavior of the margins. And there's right here this tail behavior of the margins. It matters in a bit delicate way, and that's basically the main finding in our paper. I mean, the margins seem to be the same. I have chosen it exactly to be so that they have the same tail index, so have the same tail behavior. So in this sense, they are the same, or they look the same. Our main finding in our paper is that it's only the so-called first-order tail behavior that is the same for this margin. There's what we call a second-order tail behavior, which is very different, and which in fact then exactly causes these huge jumps in diversification benefits. So that was one of our key findings. So now then, let's go back to our what I call this toy model now without dependence. But as I said, dependence is maybe not so important as one might think in the beginning. So what we did, what was the setup then, we take heavy tails, which is in line with the style aspects for operational risk, I would say. Then fixing the notation, just I consider the distribution of the sum here, the tail quantile function here I will need later. Then without going into details here, we can show that in the limit for high levels, this risk concentration factor tends to this value d to the xi minus 1. So d is your number of business line, xi is the index of regular variation, or tail index, 1 over the index of regular variation. So this gives you already a first very easy approximation. I mean, doing this theoretically is not possible probably because you have these convolutions here. So you have an easy approximation for this, a first order approximation. You could say at least for large values of alpha, you can just take this value here. It's even a very simple one. You know already the number of business lines, of course. You just need to estimate this xi here. The point is, and I want to show this on the next slide, I want to convince you that it's probably not a very good approximation. It's a similar situation as before. I consider now two IID bars, two Pareto variables and two G&H variables. I just picked three models that at some point have been proposed as severity models for operational losses. Randomly, same tail index again, so that we have kind of a comparison. Then I simulated again these diversification effects or risk concentration effects. And because they have the same tail index, they have the same first order approximation. It is just constant in alpha, so you have just this line here. But basically, this line gives you now the approximation to these curves here, and it's very clear that it's not a very good approximation. So maybe not a good idea to stop here and just consider this first order term when you want to analyze diversification. I mean, tail index of your underlying loss model. It's always the same here. Xi. At the moment, yes. I will tell about future work in the end. You can change this probably. But at the moment, we assume this, yeah. It's not much work to do to generalize this probably. We didn't do it so far, but you can do it. Yeah, let's say like this, yeah, exactly. So as I said, as it seems, it's exactly in regions where you need it. I mean, we need it at the 99.9 level. Exactly here, it seems, in these relevant regions, this risk concentration or this diversification is extremely sensitive to small changes in your alpha value. So maybe at one level, you have diversification of 10%. Ultimately, here, at least, you have diversification of 29%. But then once you move to the 99.9 level, it may happen, depending on your underlying loss model, that you jump up here, and already at this very high level you have maybe a negative diversification benefit of only 10% compared to this almost 30% which you would have ultimately. So of course we were then interested in finding what are the driving factors here that caused this sensitivity here. Basically we wanted to have a better approximation for these curves here than just this constant line, which doesn't seem to work very well, obviously. So we needed some kind of a second order result. Don't want to bother you with any mathematical details, just want to tell you a little bit that we have to consider somehow these two different cases, more or less, which I showed in the beginning. So what we wanted, mathematically we would say we want a convergence rate result here. We want to find such an A function in a K such that we have this what we call second order result. And then means when you look at it, the hard part will be then to find this A. And once you do all these steps, you will find out that somehow two different regimes matter, and this is exactly what I showed you before, more or less this case 1 and 2. Somehow you need to find out which of these two convergences is faster, or which one will dominate in the limit. One will just vanish to zero, and so you're left with the other one. So you need to work out this a little bit, so putting together all the epsilons, let's say, we then did this result. So under some mild conditions on this U function, and it's really mild conditions which are basically satisfied by every model in practice you use, log normal, Pareto, Chindage, Burr, whatever you like. So really this holds for all these models you want to use. What you have then next to this first order term, we have now a second order term that indeed depends on this alpha level, so not just a constant that tries to model your diversification benefit, but a term that depends on alpha for some constant that you can work out. And as I said, somehow you need to distinguish these two different regimes depending on your underlying loss distribution. That's our first implication. As it seems, there are somehow these two different regimes of diversification effects that puzzled us a little bit in the beginning. It's not so easy to analyze this, apparently. Furthermore, then we have the second order term. Now we hope, of course, that we can get a better grasp on diversification than just having these constants here. So let me show, this is a picture from before, and then I want to somehow complement this with our second order correction. You see these colored lines here, this the green one for the Pareto, it seems to work pretty well, at least in the region where we need it. The red also for the G&H, the blue one for the Burr, so it gives you really a better idea what's going on with respect to diversification than just looking at this constant line here. So in the region where we want it, seems to work pretty well. Of course, once you have this, you can do now this whole sensitivity analysis and look what, if you change your underlying factors, what happens to your diversification benefits. So if you do this, I just did it for this Pareto case. In the left picture, I varied now the number of business lines. In the right picture, I keep that business line number equal to 2 and varied the heavy tailedness. So what you see, the red lines are again the second order approximations to the theoretical order, empirical based on 10 to the 7 simulations. And again here, just to show you, it works pretty well in the regions where you need it. Basically, the bottom line is that you don't really need to always simulate this huge amount of heavy-tailed data that you need in order to have these smooth curves, otherwise it would be very wiggly. You couldn't see anything at all. So the errors are negligible in the area we need it, so you can just probably stick to this approximation in order to analyze these diversification benefits a little bit more instead of needing to simulate these tons of data all the time. And so also because it's an analytic approach, you can easily see what are the main influence factors that cause diversification or that do not cause diversification. So let me come to a conclusion, kind of a conclusion from the first part. Again, maybe the most important point is this fallacy that diversification occurs mainly or only due to dependence in the data. This is clearly not true. At least as important or probably more important driver is the tail behavior of your margins. So if you change the margins a little bit, you can have these huge jumps from positive to negative diversification and the other way around. A further point, diversification benefits seem to be extremely sensitive to your value at risk level. So maybe at the 99.95 you have 20% diversification, but at the level where you need it, it jumps to negative diversification. So in this sense, it's really hard to analyze or hard to justify a given degree of dependence in practice, given degree of diversification in practice. Also, and I didn't talk too much about this here, but that's basically a result that you have when you do this sensitivity analysis a little bit more in detail, that actually it happens quite often that you have these negative diversification effects at the 99.9 level. It happens more often than is commonly believed, probably. I mean, of course, negative diversification in finite mean models, in infinite mean models is well known. Of course, there you have these negative diversification effects anyway. But in finite mean models in particular, because of these huge jumps at high levels, that can happen easily that you jump into a negative diversification regime. So that is another main finding. Just a summary of the paper or the part itself. What we did, or we wanted to do, we wanted to come up with some kind of a tool to assess the sensitivity of such diversification benefits with respect to changes in your underlying input variable. So you can now play around with the underlying model and see how does this affect your diversification. You can play around with the number of risks, can play around with the level of alpha, and as we saw, the alpha level is very crucial because it's very sensitive there. Furthermore, I mean, as I said, it's toy model is just the IID case, but nevertheless, it's what we call this Fréchet lower bound case, and in this sense, it's the best case scenario for diversification, so it gives you an upper bound on diversification effects. You cannot have more diversification justified than in this IID case. So in this sense, this gives you somehow kind of a consistency check for models. I mean, if you come here and give me a log normal model and tell me that you have found due to correlation effects in your data a diversification level of 20%, then you can easily check whether this makes sense or not. I mean, maybe it's even above this best case, and then I will send you back and maybe you should look again at your model and come up with a different number here. So then future work, this is basically trying to answer your question. Of course, dependence matters. Maybe it matters not so much that we thought initially. So we would like to incorporate dependence, of course, at some point. So what the first step will be that we go from this IID case to, let's say, just the independence case, and then we take different distributions, different heavy tailnesses. I think we didn't do the details. We had a brief look at it back at ETH with Dominic Lambricke, and I think it should be straightforward, basically, from this case, because what happens if you have different tail indices, in the sum, of course, only the heaviest tail will matter. So basically, you just need to bother about this one F5 with the heaviest tail. Maybe in a second order result, also the second heaviest tail will matter. But you can basically forget about the rest of the tails. Then I think you can just use these results here to also deal with this case there. Then the much harder step to do is then, of course, to try to do this in more or full generality, try to model this dependence with a copula. I personally would start with an Archimedean copula and try to use a regularly varying generator so that you have again this regular variation there which you need for these results. Maybe you can do something there. Then last but not least, of course, at some point it would be nice you can use, of course, this result theoretically to also estimate diversification benefits. It's probably hard at the moment because of a lack of historical data, but in principle you could do it. So in the future, probably the idea would be I would start with penultimate approximations here, and I don't want to go into more details, but I think that could be a possible approach there to use. So then let me come to my second part of this talk, the analysis, or how to analyze the accuracy of this, what people call usually closed form op-var approximations. I think it's also called the single loss approximation. So as I said in the beginning, it's basically an application of this part one. It's work in progress. It's really that stuff that I'm doing right now at Cornell in the last 2 weeks, and also a little bit of DTH in my last days there. So where are we? Just to remind you, this part one we did now. I want to focus now on one single business line, so on one of these SIs. I want to model the total loss in one business unit. Then have a look at how to calculate this high quantile for this loss in one business unit. Now, what is done usually in practice, as far as I know, the people consider this, I would say, this classical actuarial model for non-life, that you have somehow this total loss process, you have this claim number process N of T, usually Poisson process probably. Most of the banks will use Poisson. Should be, at least in the model, is independent of your single losses X, which all follow the same distribution in this model. So we have this stochastic process here, and I mean, in our context, it's even a little bit easier. We don't have really this stochastic process notation. We consider a static framework, T is fixed 1 year, so we can just leave away these T's, and then we don't have this process notation, just random variables. Again, as before, G is the distribution of the sum. In this case, it's of course a little bit more involved because we have this stochastic N here. So distribution is a bit nasty there. Just to fix the notation, this G is the sum. Then what you have, I think it goes even back to Paul and his co-workers in 79, under some conditions on this N, I think the probability generating function has to be analytic in one or something like this, so it's satisfied by Poisson, negative binomial, so it's not very restrictive here that you have this kind of sub-exponentiality result, but now for a random number of losses. It's known for a long time. That was basically the motivation then for Böcker and Klüppelberg, as far as I saw it, because it relates, of course, the single loss model through this relation to the total loss model. And then what they did, basically just invert this relation to have an expression also for the corresponding quantiles, because we are interested in this quantile of the sum here, and this is related to the quantile of the single loss just in this way. That's what they derived some years ago. I mean, it's of course very unpleasant here that you have this little O of one term, you cannot really work with that. But once you assume heavy tails here, then you can just forget about this term, this cancels out to zero. What I do, I will do that and then call this different level here alpha tilde, so this will be the alpha tilde on my next slide. So basically, if you have heavy tails, then you have this, what they call this closed form Opwahr approximation. So value at risk of the sum at the level alpha is approximated according to this result to value at risk by value at risk of the single loss at this higher level alpha tilde. I mean, it is higher as soon as you have one more than one loss here. One more than one expected loss, you have a higher level. If you have 100 losses, you have a much higher level, for instance. So you have this result here. Now, as it seems from what I have heard, it really seems to be used in practice by what is called at least one systemically important bank to calculate their capital. And I think it's kind of dangerous once they do this. Because as far as I know, that's not very much known about how accurate this approximation is. They just use it to calculate the capital. They have basically no idea, I would say, whether this is a good approximation or not. It is an approximation, no doubt, but whether it is a good one or not is not clear. It has been considered in some simulation studies, but not so much on an analytical level, the goodness of this approximation. Of course, you could ask, does it matter? Because we look at very high levels, so it will be very close. No, yes, it does matter. It gives you very different results, even at high levels. And the motivating example I want to do here, I looked at the relative error, just a very simple simulation example. So this is the closed form approximation. I look at the error which you have compared to the true underlying value at risk of the sum. For simplicity, I just took a very easy model to generate from, so a Pareto as a single loss model, and also because I did not always want to generate, let's say, a Poisson number of losses, I just looked at the fixed number of losses. Of course, this result also holds for fixed number of losses in particular. So just to keep things simple, I did a non-random number of losses with a Pareto single loss model. Then what I wanted to do, just a brief simulation here, I compare now this relative error on the y-axis. Here the alpha levels are very high. Here is the 99 level. Here is the 99.9 level. So very close to 1 only. And compare these relative errors which you have once you take sum of IID Paretos. If you take 2, 10, 50 or 100 losses, I'll say this bank has a 50 losses in one of their business lines over 1 year. Maybe they were to model it with a Pareto. Then they have once they use this approximation, they have error of around 40%. If they have 100 losses, even higher. So apparently, it really does matter this accuracy here. It is not at all a good approximation as it seems in this easy Pareto example. So as it seems, I mean, here are negative errors, of course. So in this sense, it vastly underestimates risk capital once you use this approach. Again, you can ask now what are the driving factors that cause these very large errors here. And once you find out what these factors are, maybe you can correct for that factors, and then you have a better approximation. That was the aim then, and that's basically now the connection to part one. You can do this but more or less in the same framework. The only thing you have to do, at least at first sight, you have to replace these deterministic sums. This deterministic number of business lines are now stochastic number of single losses. That's the only change. You go from deterministic to stochastic. Of course, the ingredients become a little bit more involved because you have this random number of losses. But once you work out the details, then again, don't want to go into too many details here, just under some mild conditions. Again, it's basically the same conditions than before. One additional condition that you need to have here, under some conditions, you can now control this error which you have. This error, this relative error of the single loss approximation has now this form. And bottom line is, the error grows like, in first order at least, like this constant k, which you can work out, times this a, and the a in fact is the same as before, so really is an application of that before. Now, just implication or a simple example, how does this k and this a look like? Now we take a Poisson number of losses, again this Pareto loss model in the finite mean case, then this k is a rather simple form, the a also, so nothing very special here. In particular for the level where we need it, so for the 99.9 level, you can now assess the sensitivity of this error here with respect to the changing your input parameters. So again, if you fix the heavy tailedness, then you see that the error increases with increasing number of expected losses. This is intuitively clear and increases in this particular form here. So as a power of this expected number of losses, once you fix the number of losses, you will see that the error decreases with increasing heavy tailedness. So the heavier the tails, the better this approximation should work. Intuitively, this is also clear because the heavier the tails, the more the sum is just dominated by one large loss. So in this sense, it is somehow one can expect that in this case it should work well. Then further implication, or basically just the result itself. Again, you have now a control of this error, and then once you have this, you can hope that you can adjust for this and come up with a better approximation than this single loss approximation here. Just to show you, this is now the same picture than before, and now I complement it with this adjusted version, this second order refinement. And what you see, apparently it's just one example of course, but in this case it seems really that this second order term kills most of the error already. So in this case, if you would go for the second order approximation, you would at least have a much better approximation than just using the single loss approximation without second order correction. So bottom line, it really seems for some examples, I didn't have time so far to check many different cases, but for the most usual examples, it seems that it's really second order term already explains quite a lot of this discrepancy between the true and the disclosed form approximation of Böckler and Klüppelberg. And then you can use this to come up with a better approximation, basically. So I think my time is close to being up, so let me summarize. As I said, I mean, it's ongoing work, so at least it seems at the moment that for some loss models which I have looked at, that this closed form approximation really highly underestimates capital, so it's probably dangerous to use it. It also seems that once you would consider the second order refinement, it might be helpful to understand why this is the case. And then, of course, act correspondingly, and probably act correspondingly would mean that either you don't use this approach, or then at least try to use a second-order approach, second-order refinement, which gives you better results. But I think that's difficult at the moment to use the second-order approach because of the, as we all know, the lack of the data. It's not so easy to come up with a good solution there because you need to estimate, of course, this second-order refinement. But at least tells you that the first order doesn't work and what are the reasons for that. Then finally, it indeed very much seems that one should really have a recharge carefully again these closed form approximations and maybe talk again to these banks that are really using this model because really it seems to highly underestimate this capital. So thank you very much.